You're listening to FMGRadio.com. Welcome to Generation Reinvention, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Future, with your host, Brent Green.
Let's begin today by discussing a group of men. They are men now somewhere between the mid-40s and mid-60s. They are members of the demographic birth boom from 1946 to 1964. They became the nexus of modern marketing as they passed from childhood into puberty and then young adulthood. They were active spectators during the advent of broadcast television as the preeminent mass marketing medium. They listened as radio transformed from AM to FM and then XM. They read a proliferation of edgy new magazines full of swagger and emerging lifestyle alternatives. They enjoyed exceptional privileges as consumers. So many product choices, so accessible, so easy to buy and replace. They collected consciousness around clicky fads. And they demonstrated noteworthy differences from their careful and dutiful fathers who had lived through the Great Depression and World War II. They were much more open to experimentation, more willing to let go of austere Victorian-era strictures about pursuing self-gratification, more capable of adaptation to change as technology exploded into one product innovation after another. This realm of boomer men is vigorous with idealism, even now, so many years after their youthful days of high purposes and protests. They can be ideological, as is true for their entire generation, but they can also be flexible, adapting to present circumstances with malleable points of view. The culture can be sober, circumspect, and reserved, and yet the ambiance can be hopeful, even buoyant. The best days are yet to be. Being male and being of the boomer generation has shaped them in unique ways that inform who they have become. This information can propel industries even as their consumption preferences and values are maturing and changing once again. I have just read an apropos excerpt from my newest book, Generation Reinvention, which has a special section focused on business and boomer men. So who are they, really? Well, no individual completely defines a generation, but it has been my privilege to get to know many extraordinary boomer men who have accomplished much and lived many of their values from youth. One of them is with me today. Brian Welch and his family raised cattle, sheep, goats, and chickens on a 50-acre farm, which they call Rancho Cappuccino. All their animals range freely, and the grazing animals are strictly grass-fed. He grew up in New Mexico where, starting at age 9, he cared for a neighbor's dairy goats and other livestock. When he's not farming, he runs Ogden Publications, a diversified media consulting and affinity marketing company. His company has grown rapidly over the past few years and now publishes 10 magazines for people interested in self-sufficiency, sustainability, rural lifestyles, and farm collectibles. Familiar titles include Mother Earth News, Utney Reader, Natural Home, and The Herb Companion. Combined, the publishers' magazines have over 2 million readers, and their websites attract more than 3 million unique visitors each month. Ogden also publishes books and markets insurance and financial services to its subscribers. About a third of its gross revenue comes from these ancillary marketing programs. So I'd like to welcome our special guest, Brian Welch. How are you today, Brian?
I'm fine, Brent. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Now, are you at Rancho Cappuccino or at Ogden Publications right now?
I'm at Ogden Publications this afternoon.
Could we have this conversation if you were at Rancho Cappuccino?
Oh, sure. Rancho Cappuccino has broadband internet service. So, yes, we could probably do this most anywhere. It's a fully wired rancho.
Okay, and I think the cappuccino part came in because you are blessedly rather a short distance from Starbucks. Is that correct?
Well, yes. You know, I was at a party or something one night, and a guy was kidding me. Well, first he started out by asking me why we would choose to voluntarily farm, which to him seemed like not a natural lifestyle choice. And I said, oh, gosh, you know, we really enjoy it. And besides, you know, it's not like we're way out in the boonies or anything. We're just like 2 miles from the nearest Starbucks. And the guy said, oh, I know what you are. You're one of those cappuccino cowboys. And I think he meant it to be a jab, but, you know, I thought, well, you know, I am kind of a cappuccino cowboy. And so ever since then, I've worn the badge proudly.
You have said, and I'm going to quote here, we're lucky enough to make a good living elsewhere, so we can enjoy the farm as a refuge, an avocation, a source of physical and spiritual nourishment, an amateur work of art. It's sad, though, isn't it, that just a few years ago, most farms were all those things. Now, what did you mean by that, Brian?
You know, that's really interesting you put it that way, Brent, because, yes, I think a generation or two ago that most farms had a very artistic element in them and provided a wonderful lifestyle in addition to providing a lot of food. The, you know, today's farm economy puts a lot more pressure on the farmer to produce in huge quantities, very specific crops under very specific circumstances with very particular genetics. And all that combined has made farms a lot less diverse. It's made farms, I think, a lot less holistic, and it's turned some of our richest farmland into kind of a food factory where, you know, you'd go a long ways across big swaths of the Midwestern United States without seeing a vegetable garden, just miles and miles and miles of corn and soybeans. And I guess I regret that a little bit. I mean, I understand the economic pressures that have brought it to bear, but farming as a lifestyle can be such a joyful, holistic, wholesome, just thoroughly enjoyable, rich way of life. And I think I sort of fell in love with it as that when I was a kid and feel quite privileged to be able to live that kind of traditional agricultural lifestyle as an adult. But I don't think it's unrealistic for a lot of people. The fact of the matter is if we had to make our living farming, we'd either need a sort of irrational amount of money invested in real estate, or we would need to have inherited that irrational asset. The fact that we can, you know, pay for medical care and mortgage and food and all the rest, the food we don't grow and all the rest from our other jobs means that we can fashion a farming lifestyle that's, as I say, kind of artistic, kind of holistic, that's fashioned to reflect a set of values. And I think, you know, I think to us that's quite beautiful and quite joyful and a real nice thing to be able to do.
It's a wonderful blend of focus. Now, given your interest in farming and nature, which are clear-cut, and our listeners are going to learn more about that as we go through the program, what drew you to magazine publishing? What kept you involved?
Oh, well, storytelling has pretty much always been my vocation in one way or another. I worked in lots of different media over the years, but I was drawn to the publishing business, the media business, because I'm a storyteller by nature. It's innate with me. And so I set out very early in my life to try to figure out a way to do that for a living. I was lucky enough to get to do it for a living. And I would hate to be without that as a that daily diet of storytelling. And I'm also a businessman. You know, I'm a person who likes to find real fundamental economic value in my activities. And so on the farm, that means we sell a lot of meat and we sell some eggs and we derive a certain amount of revenue from our farming, which I think is a good way of sort of validating the activity. And it means that when I write a story, I like to figure out I like to find an audience that thinks it's worth something economically so that that can be turned into business. And by extension, running a publishing company, running a media company as I do today, is the same activity, I think. To me, it has the same natural feel, both natural in the sense that it's perfectly natural for people to love stories and to pay for them, and it's natural for me personally as an individual because storytelling is just part of my nature.
For the benefit of our listeners, I've never seen Brian's farm, but yet I can see it because for pinpointing this, Brian is located near Lawrence, Kansas, which of course is the University of Kansas, which of course is my alma mater. And I spent much time in the farmlands around Lawrence. And if you have this image of a flat and dry Kansas, discard it. It's hilly. It's verdant. It's beautiful. And this is a tremendous location. So anyway, I just wanted to be sure our listeners had the benefit of some visual sense of when you talk about this farm, they can see it in their minds as I can. So how does your work as a farm and rancher inform your work at the helm of Ogden Publications? How does it kind of direct your thinking, if you will? How do they influence each other?
That's a great question. It's a very big question for me, Brent.
Yeah.
I mean, the most obvious way in which it informs my work is that many of the media brands that we own have to do with self-reliance and sustainability. And that's the preoccupation of our farming as well. So in that way, you know, sort of a direct correlation. Another way in which it informs my professional life is, I think, simply by grounding me in the natural world. Farming is, I think, the best way of connecting on a daily basis with the fundamentals of natural existence. You know, things are born and things die, and the grass grows and turns into the food that you and your family consume. You're out in the weather, no matter what that weather brings. You're taking care of other creatures that you care about, and they're interacting with you. It's a kind of a dioramic experience, if you will, on a daily basis of being immersed in nature's machinery. And for me, that keeps me connected to the fundamentals of my existence in a way that very few activities could. And I think it helps me keep business in perspective. And I guess I would go farther and say it's also kept me enthusiastic and joyful about my work in business, I think, to a degree, because it balances my life so well. So, you know, after a long weekend of fixing fences or moving manure around, I kind of look forward to going in and sitting at the desk, you know what I mean?
Right. And as people will learn when they learn about you, and before this program's over, they'll learn some, but I'm going to tell them how to learn more. They'll learn that you're a very, very kind and gentle custodian of your animals. And I had to wonder if some of that attitude doesn't get carried forward to the human animals that you take care of 8 to 5, Monday through Friday.
I suppose you'd have to seek out their opinions on that. But I do think that in order to have compassion for ourselves, we have to live in a compassionate way and have compassion for other living things. And there is a sort of daily lesson when you raise animals, particularly if you raise animals for meat. There's some daily instruction as to how best to care for other living creatures and what sort of treatment you yourself desire from the universe. And I suppose, you know, that probably does inform how I manage a business as well. Certainly I hope it does. Certainly I hope that I am reflecting as much compassion as I'm seeking.
I've had the opportunity to hear you speak, and I'm very clear about your self-description of being a storyteller. I wonder, obviously you're a writer and an editor, but again, in working in your companies with the various publications, I'm wondering if your storytelling art also plays a role in motivating people and moving them forward in the same direction.
Certainly it's a motivator for me. Great stories are a primary motivator for me, and one of the primary ways that I interpret existence as a reader, as a consumer of stories, there's just no question that that various kinds of stories have done a lot to form my awareness. And so, yeah, I think I automatically utilize storytelling as a management tool. I can't imagine doing otherwise. And if you tried to stop me from telling stories, it you know, would probably cause some kind of permanent psychological damage. I'm absolutely incapable of not telling stories as far as I can tell. So, you know, go with the flow, right?
Exactly. Well, we're going to take a short break for our sponsors. My guest is Brian Welch, a committed farmer, rancher, magazine publisher, and author. I met Brian last year at the LOHAS Forum. LOHAS, an acronym standing for Lifestyles of Health and Sustainability, which is an exceptional gathering of business and thought leaders examining the intersection of how business can work with conscious consumerism. Under the capable direction of Ted Ning, the forum's annual conference will be in Boulder, Colorado early this summer. And you can find out more about the LOHAS Forum by going to LOHASForum.com. Brian is a featured speaker again this year. When we come back, we'll discuss some of the distinctive magazines published by Brian's firm.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
Before starting Ogden Publications in 1996, my guest, Brian Welch, spent 19 years as a reporter, photographer, editor, and publisher of newspapers in Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, Washington, and Connecticut. He holds a master's degree from Harvard University, where he studied media policy and media management at the Kennedy School of Government and Harvard Business School. Professionally, he's busy too. He is a member of the Magazine Publishers of America Board of Directors, the Kansas Land Trust Board of Directors, and the Down Home Ranch Foundation Board of Directors. He has served as chairman of the Independent Magazine Advisory Group with the Magazine Publishers of America. So this, like many of our guests, is a very busy individual. Well, let's talk about Ogden Publications, and clearly we do not have time to discuss 10 magazines. But I would like to touch upon the four obviously larger magazines of the group you carry, beginning with perhaps among the boomer generation, the most famous, Mother Earth News. Now, the way the publisher describes this magazine is this way: the most popular and longest running sustainable lifestyle magazine, Mother Earth News, provides wide ranging expert editorial coverage of organic foods, country living, green transportation, renewable energy, natural health, and green building. So, bring us up to speed. What really is Mother Earth News, and what's its heritage, Brian?
Well, what it is a magazine about cool stuff you can do to live a more conscientious life. And that's pretty much what it's always been, although like any media brand, it's evolved over the years. It started in 1970. Was conceived on the kitchen table of a couple, John Shuttleworth and his wife Jane, and their notion was there was a new value system in the world in 1970 that harkened back to a much older value system that valued self-reliance and conscientiousness as cornerstones for living, and Mother Earth News adopted that those values and put them forward under a persona that also mixed in a lot of joy in the exercise of self-reliance and conscientiousness toward a goal of sustainability. So, yeah, that's still what we're about. We're still about cool stuff you can do that makes a positive difference in the world.
You know, for our younger readers' benefit, 1970 is significant in the environmental movement because April 22nd of that year was the first Earth Day. And around that was a rising environmental consciousness that offset a disastrous environmental environment where we saw terrible smog over Los Angeles and burning fires on rivers up north and real concern about how much we were polluting our environment. Do you think they might have been motivated by those times in their own decisions to produce this magazine?
Well, sure. There was a zeitgeist at the time. There was a sea change occurring at the time in people's attitudes. You know, I find one of the more extraordinary things about our own lifetimes, Brent, is the fact that we've discovered that we're the only living thing, the only species, so far as we know, that can conceptualize its own impact on its habitat. Just one species in the universe, and that's us. But we really hadn't grappled with that impact or addressed that uniquely human capability until the past 40 years or so. And you and I have been alive through this dramatic time in human history when we're coming to grips with the limits of our own planet for the first time. It's in some way, it's the I would call it the definitive human puzzle, and we're getting to address that puzzle. That realization, I think, began in the 40s and 50s and came to a sort of fruition in the 60s and early 70s as the young people of the time, including you and I, adopted those values and began to exercise them in our own lives. It's a puzzle. I think it's a rather vexing question why the values of sustainability and environmentalism are still controversial today in light of the fact that everybody wants clean air and clean water. But they are, and going forward, I think a puzzle that we all face is how do we make that value system that preserves our environment central to human behavior, to human morality, to human ethics worldwide? That's a question that I find most interesting and the focus of a lot of my work.
Interesting that, you know, this magazine kind of had its seed time in the 1970s, but yet its message is valid and all the more relevant today as we look at boomers like Al Gore take the message, the environmental message, forward. And so to those listeners who really want to come in touch with a very fundamental way to experience their environment differently, then obviously Mother Earth News is full of opportunity there. Now let's talk about Utney Reader. Utney Reader and Utney.com are digests of independent ideas and alternative culture, not right, not left, but forward thinking. As the publisher says, we're most interested in creating a conversation about everything from the environment to the economy, politics to pop culture. So again, what's Utney Reader for those who may not be familiar with it?
Yeah, Utney Reader, Eric Utney started Utney Reader up in 1984 with the idea that there were so many brilliant little magazines, small presses across the country sharing wonderful thoughts and terrific stories, that it made sense to aggregate them in some way, in sort of the way that widespread independent voices are being aggregated by the internet today. Eric had the bright idea of doing that in a magazine in the 1980s, and it caught on right away. And it's been a fairly significant force on the American media landscape ever since. So it remains today a compendium of some of the stories and viewpoints that we find most interesting. It's not political any more than it is social and philosophical. And, you know, it's really ideas from all parts of the culture and on all topics. I find it fascinating. And if you are interested in brand new ideas and sort of cutting edge thinking, it can be sort of a Bible for a person with that particular interest.
Would it be accurate to say that Utney Reader is in that group of media that influences the media? In other words, a lot of people get their thought leadership who are in the reporting media from a magazine like Utney Reader?
Maybe so, although today I would say that one of the central powers, one of the most profound things about the digital media is that the digital media can measure human interest in much more precise ways than we were ever able to before. And so most of us in the media today spend a lot of time watching readers move from one piece of content to another, how much time they spend, how far they page down in a given story. We know a lot about what fascinates people today. And so if Utney Reader is influential on the media as a whole, it would only be because we're paying very close attention to which stories and subjects the influential people who read our magazine are most interested in. We're trying to let the audience itself direct our efforts, and I think we're fairly successful at that. Our audience is full of influential people, and I would give all the credit for influencing the media as a whole to those individuals within our audience.
I see what you mean. I remember when I visited your office last year, there was an interesting cover of Sarah Palin, and obviously she was even more current than she is today.
The current issue of the magazine has Donald Trump on it. The issue before had Barack Obama on it. I mean, the covers in particular, we try to have someone recognizable on there. We think, important that people find an image that they can immediately grasp onto. And, of course, it keeps us relevant if we are making sure that we're keeping track of what individuals out there in the public realm are the most compelling individuals from month to month and issue to issue. So, yeah, we give it our best shot.
I think you give it an excellent shot, and I mentioned that Sarah Palin was the cover when I visited your offices, and I thought that was a provocative cover on a provocative subject. So definitely captured my interest.
Well, let's talk. Well, this month we actually have Donald Trump being more or less burned at the stake. So we continue to try to be provocative for sure.
Well, our readers who love great essays, great analysis, provocative thinking, they will also enjoy this magazine. Now, let's talk Natural Home for a minute. I became familiar with Natural Home when I did some marketing work for the magazine. This was before Ogden Publication purchased the magazine, but the publisher statement basically is that Natural Home is the authority on sustainable home design and materials, earth-friendly decor, and natural lifestyles. Since 1999, health-conscious, environmentally concerned consumers have turned to Natural Home for information, advice, and inspiration to create beautiful, earth-friendly living spaces. So how do you view this magazine fitting into the lifestyle of, let's just say, the environmentally conscious and beauty-conscious baby boomer woman?
These days, part of a gracious lifestyle, just like part of any luxury product, is conscientiousness, is sustainability. We don't buy products today. We don't consider a product a truly high-quality product today if it's not produced in a way that's careful about its environmental and human impacts. So I would say that Natural Home is an extension of that value system and takes more into account than the old-fashioned women's magazines that were only about makeup and pantyhose. We believe that real beauty runs a bit deeper than that, that a gracious lifestyle for a contemporary woman has many elements beyond that go deep below the surface. It certainly includes a high quality linen and beautiful clothing and good luggage and the rest, but it also includes reflects a highly conscientious woman, a woman who understands where she is in the world and is doing her best to exercise her power in responsible ways. And so, I would say that it's an extension of the traditional women's home sort of magazine with a new layer of conscientiousness on it.
One of my unique challenges in my career was to write in the voice of a woman for Natural Home Magazine. And according to the then editor, I apparently accomplished that objective. But we writers are challenged, but this was one of the more unusual ones that I was asked to undertake. Well,
I'm tempted to say that I find writing in a woman's voice easier than you do, Brent, but perhaps that's revealing too much.
Well, okay. Anyway, my guest today, Brian Welch, wrote a poignant description of his newest book, Beautiful and Abundant. And here's how he put it. Quote, "Humanity is at a turning point. Only one species in the universe can recognize its own impact on its habitat, so far as we know, and we are that species." We'll discuss Brian's inspiring book when we come back.
Be sure to join us at fmguniversity.com, where we can turn your passion into business within 30 days, put some fun back into your life, and show you how to make money and do good for yourself and others. That's why we're called FMG, Fun, Money, Good. Get started today. Visit us at fmguniversity.com.
My guest today, Brian Welch, is going to be in Boulder, Colorado in June for the LOHAS Forum. And I want you to consider going to this, not only to hear Brian, but also the fabulous lineup of speakers who truly are at the very leading edge of human thought today in the areas of sustainability, the environment, conscious consumerism, and so forth. And Brian wrote a beautiful book that I heard him speak about. I didn't know he was talking about his book, but as I listened back to his interview, or the actual speech itself, which I happened to tape record, I said, well, wait a minute, this is material from his new book. Brian, you begin your book by describing an experience when you nearly killed yourself on a motorcycle due to, quote, poor visualization, unquote. Share with our listeners what happened and why this idea of visualization is an important underpinning concept in your book.
Well, you know, I didn't invent the idea. I think every motorcyclist knows either literally or intuitively that when you're riding a motorcycle and you're on a curvy road, you need to train your attention at the exit from the curve. You need to be visualizing a successful exit from the real world experience you're in the middle of. And my basic mistake was to lose confidence, and rather than visualizing a successful completion of the turn, to become preoccupied with a rapidly approaching guardrail, so preoccupied that I managed to aim the motorcycle at it and bounce off of it into the middle of the highway and go skidding down the highway at something close to 50 miles an hour on my face, which was thankfully encased in a high quality helmet at the time. But definitely a wake up call. I would love to say that that I came up with the idea for the book as I was bouncing down the middle of that highway. In fact, it was I did more or less come up with this idea a few days later when I was recovering from the accident. No real serious damage after all, but some bruises. And I got to thinking, well, you know, what's the root cause of this catastrophe that I've created here? And it seemed fairly clear that rather than visualizing a successful outcome of that particular maneuver, I became preoccupied with an obstacle and with a predicament I'd gotten myself into. I could have, I mean, other riders around me successfully negotiated that curve at that speed. I had a good motorcycle with good tires, absolutely no reason that I shouldn't have successfully exited that corner at that speed, but I lost confidence and I didn't visualize successfully. I think that's not a bad metaphor for where we're at as a species. When we talk about the environment, we're very preoccupied with the obstacles. Climate change, species loss, deforestation, desertification, pollution, all these words are familiar to anybody who listens to the radio or watches television or reads the newspapers today.
I found when I thought about it that for somebody like me whose daily work is engaged with environmental issues, I realized that I virtually never heard anybody talk about what kind of world we really want our great-grandchildren to live in. And I thought, well, that's, you know, a remarkable absence. It's a remarkable oversight on our part not to be training attention and energy on the goal that we wish to reach. I have a friend who for many years raced mountain bikes, and he was telling me, we were talking about some of these issues, he was telling me about what they call, what racers call, the destination fixation. You're riding a mountain bike on steep terrain with lots of obstacles. You could easily train your attention close to the bike at the next rock or gully or whatever that might trip you up, turn you over, ruin your race day. So you're trained, in fact, to look down the mountain to where you want to be in a few seconds, which of course can be, you know, dozens of yards down the mountain. And they call that their destination fixation. And they consider it a very important part of racing, a very important part of sports psychology. And it occurred to me it's a very important part of human psychology in general. I believe that we've got our attention trained on the obstacles and we're running a risk of hitting those obstacles for the lack of a positive vision. And my biggest motivator for writing the book was my desire to get the conversation about that positive vision started, to start engaging people in that discussion. I'm not particularly promoting my own positive vision. I want to start a conversation that involves a lot of people, if I can.
You said that, and again, I quote from your book, by focusing most of our efforts on conservation, we distract ourselves from more complex and critical puzzles involving economics and population. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, the third rail of the environmental discussion is population. In my lifetime, the human population has just about doubled. The United States, which has a relatively moderate rate of population growth compared to other countries, is adding a new Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area to its population every year. So if you want to visualize what that means for the environment, imagine a city the size of Minneapolis-St. Paul. Imagine building one of those every year in the United States right now. What impact does that have on the environment? Well, obviously a profound impact. And by most standards, a profoundly negative impact. That's what we're doing with the population today. In many places, the population is growing much more rapidly. And many of the most vexing environmental problems are directly traceable to human population growth. Species loss is directly traceable to human population growth. Most deforestation, about 80% of all deforestation around the globe, is carried on to clear land for agriculture. So it's not big timber companies cutting down trees to make fancy paneling or fancy furniture. It's poor farmers cutting down and burning trees so that they can plant enough land to feed their kids. All of this is driven, obviously, by population, and population remains a taboo subject in polite company today. I think that's quite dangerous, and it's time to start matter-of-factly discussing it. I don't advocate government controls on population. I advocate that a widespread global human discussion of that issue and an acknowledgement that it's a very serious issue when we're talking about the welfare of our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren. Even population is a relatively easy subject compared to the economics of our situation. Whatever you think about population growth and the human population as an abstract concept, any person, any rational person would have to acknowledge that at some point it will need to be stabilized if we're going to preserve our habitat, if we're going to preserve a healthy place for us to live, our species to live. So with that in mind, at some point, the human population will be either stagnant or shrinking. Today, economic growth is wholly contingent upon population growth. You know, we're very proud of our several centuries of economic growth and growing sophistication in human technology. But of course, all of that has been driven to one extent or another by growing demand in the form of more customers every single year. Try to imagine an economy in which every home is worth a bit less year after year because there are fewer people looking to buy houses, where gold is worth less year after year because there are fewer people interested in buying any gold or doing anything with it. You begin to see that all of the underpinnings of our economy, even those we put the most faith in, are really only valuable because of growing demand, and growing demand fundamentally only exists because population grows. And so I think the one big puzzle we haven't even begun to solve is the vexing challenge of designing an economy, designing industry, designing financial instruments that create prosperity without a growing population base. And I find that fascinating and extremely challenging to think about.
Extraordinarily challenging. It just boggles the mind to think about how do we completely change our paradigms and how do we start producing more people than this planet may be able to accommodate. You, in this book, one of the things that impressed me is that not only do you bring forward some very keen thinking, but you also balance that with what you call meditations throughout the book. And these take you into a different place to understand some of the thought processes going on. I guess you could say more the right brain than the left brain. I read one line that really captured my attention. It says, to love nature, we have to accept its ruthlessness. To care for our habitat correctly, we have to appreciate its intricate, pragmatic machinery. So what do we need to understand about nature as citizens of the world that maybe we don't seem to fully understand quite yet? You mentioned population. I'm sure that's a big part of that answer. But
yeah, for all those people who deny the necessities. Pardon me?
Go ahead. That we're not grasping quite yet.
Right. For all those people who deny the necessity of eventually stabilizing our population, you know, to all of them, I would just say, yes, eventually God, in the form of nature, will limit our population for us. You'll have no trouble in finding examples of nature limiting the populations of various species, and nature could do the same for us. When that happens, though, it usually involves things like mass starvation, epidemics of disease, great numbers of corpses piling up. I don't think we want to leave it up to nature, in other words. I think nature's machinery in this case would do a lot of damage to humanity. And I'm very quick to point out, by the way, that my kind of environmentalism is not so much about saving nature or any particular part of nature. It's really a lot more about saving humanity. The world's going to be just fine, thank you very much. No matter what happens to humanity, the machinery of this planet is much more powerful than human beings at this point. And living nature, life itself, will survive our passing, I believe. I don't think we're quite powerful enough to do so much damage that there wouldn't be living things on this planet when we were done. But we do run the risk of really messing it up for us. And I think that'd be really stupid. And I'm trying to encourage people to raise these issues and to get involved in the conversation.
You make an excellent point there, because I think we do get stuck on the belief that we're going to destroy this planet and it's never going to recover. I don't know if you saw any of the TV series Life After People. Did you see any of this?
I loved it. Yeah, it was terrific.
I think it demonstrates quite well how nature can take back over even our worst piles and messes. But you do also speak in the book quite a bit about conscious capitalism, and I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit for the benefit of our listeners, because that's a big theme in a lot of the environmental conversations today.
Yeah, well, capitalism is just this brilliant creation whose primary product, I think, is the management and direction of human energy. capitalism has been extraordinarily, I mean, has been the most successful institution, I think, in stimulating and directing human activity in very creative and productive ways. So I think we need capitalism in whatever future we're going to create in order to sustain that human energy and to help us create prosperity for future generations. The idea of conscious capitalism is, I think, just a natural extension of what we've invented as capitalists so far. So far, capitalism has been about exploiting a bunch of resources that were lying around to be exploited, relatively inexpensive resources, relatively easy to tap into resources. And so we've busily gone about doing that, expanding our range, expanding our numbers, consuming resources, and building grand new stuff all over the planet. At some point or another, though, capitalism has to adjust to the fact that the world's getting more crowded, that resources are more constrained. And that calls for a brand new kind of capitalism. There's a wonderful book out right now called The New Capitalist Manifesto by Umair Haque. And Umair just does a terrific job. He's a scholar at the London School of Economics and at Harvard Business School. And he does a wonderful job of pointing out all the reasons why old-fashioned capitalism needs to evolve in order to address a brand new environment, the environment we're in today. And I believe that very strongly. I think that what we call conscious capitalism or conscientious capitalism is one of the manifestations of that evolution. It's one way in which capitalism is evolving to perform its duty and to direct human enterprise in creative and productive ways in a world where resources are relatively more constrained and in a world where the environment is relatively more crowded than it ever has been before for humanity.
Well, I certainly would look forward to taking a look at that book, Brian, but I also want to make sure our audience keeps in mind, our listeners, that Beautiful and Abundant is a remarkable book. And before the program's over, I'm going to tell you how you can get a copy. But as I mentioned earlier, you can also find out more about conscious capitalism at the Lojas Forum in Boulder this summer. And you can find out more about the forum by going to lojasforum.com. And there you can meet Brian personally. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
In the final segment of my program, I always try to encourage our guests to think about the future. And sometimes these questions can be quite challenging because, as you know, the listener knows, it's very difficult to look into a crystal ball and even know what's going to happen in 3 years. But anyway, my guest today is somebody that thinks not only a lot about the present and is informed by the past, but he also is somebody that he's got one foot in the future, looking ahead. So, Brian, when this generation that you and I are a part of, the boomer generation, is fully ensconced in the 70s and 80s, our 70s and 80s, will we still be reading magazines? And will we still need traditional magazines in your judgment?
I don't have any idea. And I'm not sure it's important. I'm not even sure it's that important. Magazines are going to get a lot better. Books are going to get a lot better. They're going to be more interactive. They're going to be available in more formats, including on e-readers. I think they'll probably still be available in print as well. Print has some very special, unique qualities that makes it valuable. But I very much look forward to being able to read a magazine or a book, spontaneously highlight a passage from what I'm reading, send it to a bunch of hand-picked friends, join a discussion among other people who also find the same thing fascinating, perhaps send an email to the author if they're available. I look forward to being able to look at maps and photographs of the settings in the piece I'm reading or the book I'm reading. I think that magazines and books, that the quote-unquote print media, are going to get a lot better in the next few years, a lot more exciting, and take a much larger share of the public's time as a result of their new assets and their new virtues. So I'm very keen on the upcoming decades for what we've called the print media, that is the written media, the textual media, because we have all these new tools, all these new features that are going to be added to that to make magazines and books more exciting than ever.
Are you working actively with your various titles to move them into e-reader kind of formats?
Sure. They are all available at Zenio.com in e-reader formats for either for several different e-reader platforms, including your personal computer. And we're working to expand those formats with new features all the time. So, yeah, it's a major part of our effort, as well as, of course, the magazine websites are more and more important every day to our readers, and they offer more and more features, more and more services every day. It's all a big, growing, and exciting part of our business.
I'm pleased to hear that, because obviously some of these magazines, like Mother Earth News, occupy a special place in the heart, if you will, of the boomer generation. And as we become older, you know, the number one hobby, if you will, according to research by AARP and other organizations, the number one hobby of baby boomers is gardening. And you can see that growing and expanding with more time and a desire to create the kind of foods that lend themselves to the healthiest results. So you recommend that we create a future vision for ourselves, Brian, wherein we can make significant contributions that meet four criteria. Those criteria are abundance, beauty, contagiousness, and fairness. Abundance, beauty, contagiousness, and fairness. So what might a vision be for the boomer generation given these criteria, abundance, beauty, contagiousness, and fairness?
What kind of world is that that's beautiful and abundant and fair? What kind of world is that? I think it's just the same kind of world that idealists have always been seeking. My goal in applying those queries to our endeavors was to try to take it down to a level where we can apply useful values toward sustainability in all of our endeavors. So if it's at our church or in our yard or at our home or in our business, whatever we're up to, if we make sure that we're creating something of beauty and that it preserves abundance for future generations and that it's fundamentally fair to the people involved and that it's done in a way that could be a contagious idea, for instance, just done in a way that will ignite the interest and the enthusiasm of other people, then we're making progress, I think, toward a truly sustainable future. And if I may, I'll point out the way in which each of those qualities is important. You know, you can't engage people in aspiration without beauty. And human creativity is absolutely necessary to our ongoing quality of life. Without extra time, extra food, extra resources, our creativity tends to dry up. We don't have the time to consider, experiment, try new stuff, create art. And that's absolutely necessary, I think, to healthy human nature. Fairness is, to my way of thinking, a fundamental ingredient in every truly successful human endeavor on a global scale, because you cannot create a global consensus if large numbers of human beings feel that your vision excludes them, that your practices put them at a disadvantage, that your value system is fundamentally unfair to them. And we need a real global consensus to pursue our goals of sustainability. So I think fairness is absolutely necessary as part of the equation. And then contagiousness is the most neglected, but obviously necessary value, I think, in discussions about sustainability and visions of sustainability.
You know, I and my peers have been talking about pollution and deforestation and desertification and species loss for decades. And they all remain highly controversial topics. There are many, many, many people in our own country who think of environmentalism as a sort of tribal movement concocted by the elites to put American productivity at a disadvantage. And that's just a really bad depiction. And we've allowed that to happen in part by acting sort of holier than thou and by not attending to the contagiousness of our ideas. Too often we've allowed ourselves to pat each other on the back and to create little enclaves of interest without really considering how could we engage the vast majority of Americans in the pursuit of a happy, sustainable, prosperous, beautiful, and abundant future. And so that's why I think contagiousness might be the most important part of my discussion. It's the element that has been most neglected by people who recognize the need for more action towards sustainability for a broader discussion of sustainability.
You know, and a lot of that contagiousness has emanated from the many people that have congregated around the LOHAS movement. And again, I point to the LOHAS Forum as a gathering of those people because, for example, research by Paul Ray and the Natural Marketing Institute have demonstrated that a lot of what we used to consider fringe green values that belong to that kind of huddled tribe of people that want to dismantle capitalism as we know it are actually going main, those values are going mainstream. And this small group of people who have a abundant, beautiful, contagious, and fair view of the future are starting to influence the thinking of the rest of the population. So
yes, and creating a lot of power by communicating with consumers. I mean, the reason business is changing is because consumers are becoming more demanding, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. They're becoming more demanding, and they are expecting more, you know, from a point of view of social responsibility, for example, of companies today. So that conversation is very much going on, and thanks to you for being very much a part of that conversation and publishing the kind of magazines that in their many forms carry a promising and optimistic message forward about the future.
Well, that's absolutely my pleasure and completely natural to me, Brent. I can't think of something more important or more interesting, more fun to do.
Well, I want to thank you, Brian, for joining us today and sharing your thoughts about both magazine publishing and the possibilities of a beautiful and abundant future. It's really been a pleasure to have you on this program today.
It was a lot of fun for me, Brent. I appreciate your having me.
Well, if you want to find out more about Brian's work, be sure to visit at least two websites to begin with. For his book, you can find more about the book and actually read parts of the book at beautifulandabundant.com. The word beautiful, and then A-N-D, and then abundant.com. You can also find more about the many publications that are produced by Ogden Publications by simply going to Ogden, O-G-D-E-N, publications.com. And there you will find a vast opportunity to learn a great deal about the opportunities that we're all confronting in a healthier, more abundant future. My guest next time is J. Mara Della Priscoli. Mara Della Priscoli, who is president of Travel Learning Connections Incorporated. She is the founder and architect of the Educational Travel Conference, which I've had the good fortune to speak at in 2007 and again in 2010. With this conference platform, she has facilitated the growth of strategic business partnerships and business-to-business networking of those in the field of alumni, museum, conservation, and affinity group travel. She has over 30 years of experience as kind of the queen mother of this industry. She has worked with most sectors of the travel industry, including marketing, sales, tour and hotel operations and transportation, trade and government research firms. Mara is, in a sense, a synonym for educational travel, and with boomers, educational travel is the future. So I want to thank you for being part of this program today, for listening to our guest, Brian Welch, and I invite you back to be part of this journey to invent and reinvent Generation Reinvention.
You've been listening to Generation Reinvention with your host, Brent Green. Visit Brent at his website at generationreinvention.com. And for archive shows, be sure to visit his show page here on the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is, have fun, make money.